Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Appreciate, as always, you tuning in. A quick thing, I'm gunning for 300 iTunes reviews / ratings, and I'm almost there. If you have a chance and you're feeling generous, head on over to iTunes and leave a handful of stars if you enjoy the show. I'm pleased to have as my guest today David R. Stokes. He's the author of a number of history-centered books, any of which we could have talked about today, but I've asked him to join me to discuss his book called Jake and Clara, Scandal, Politics, Hollywood, and Murder. And he's also been an ordained minister for 40 years. Thank you for your time.
Well, you're welcome. Good to be with you.
I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but how does a pastor become a true crime history author?
You know, my first book was actually about a minister. And he was a famous minister from the 1920s who actually shot and killed someone in his office. And that story fascinated me on a lot of levels. So from that, I sort of branched into some of the other things. And I've always enjoyed the genre in reading, and I've also enjoyed espionage and related things. So they're all sort of in the same vicinity of each other.
So this isn't a well-known story by any means, but it was pretty sensational during its day. When did you first hear about it, and what prompted you to write a book about it?
Well, I heard about the story in the research for that aforementioned first book, which was also about the 1920s. And one of the attorneys who figures prominently in the Jake and Clara story, figured prominently in the story that I wrote earlier, and he had actually made his fame. And so I sort of, as a sidebar, you know, put a little blurb about this Jake and Clara thing in the first book. But then I really thought this story has such a tie. It ties to presidential politics, big oil, Hollywood, early Hollywood, fascinating stuff. And so I really made it one of my next things to do.
So just so listeners are aware, this is historical fiction. Why did you choose this route when writing your book?
I almost wrote it as a nonfiction, or what's called narrative nonfiction, similar to David McCullough or Eric Larson, which is how I wrote the first book called The Shooting Salvationist. In this book, I found there wasn't quite as much documentary evidence for me to create compelling dialogue. All the dialogue in the other book, anything in a quote, you know, was in a published source or a private collection or something. And so because I've created some dialogue, it crossed over into fiction. It's very funny because I think there is a blurring line that's ever more blurring. Going back to Capote when he wrote In Cold Blood, he always swore that, you know, everything he put in the book was true and every quote was direct, but then there's no annotation about it. So some have wondered that. A few years ago, a book came out Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, about a story from New Orleans. And it was written, it's a true story, but the guy who wrote it with fictional, and all, when I say fiction, what I've invented is some of the dialogue that I have based on other readings, and I feel like it's words that they might have said, but the actual facts of the story, the thrust of the story, the dates of the story, and when we get to the trial part of the story, that stuff is a record, and I've quoted most of that verbatim.
So let's go over some of the main players in your book, and let's start with Jake Heyman. He's a pretty fascinating guy. Who was he, and what was his background?
Well, he was a person who was trained to be a lawyer, and then he moved this to Oklahoma to make his fortune and to make a name for himself. Oklahoma was not yet a state. It was still a territory at this time. This is right around the turn of the 20th century, end of the 19th, end of the 20th century. And so he went out there and began to work and began to try to scheme. He was a very ambitious guy. He was a bit of a megalomaniac, I guess you could say. He had his favorite person to read about was Napoleon. That's always a clue that somebody's got big, grandiose dreams and schemes. And, of course, then in the early 1900s, the oil boom started to happen as people started to shift in the world from coal to oil, and oil became a very important commodity. Certainly as we get to World War One, many of the great dreadnoughts and other ships were switching over. And so Jake was a person who was a man of his times, ambitious, somebody who wanted to make a name for himself. He wanted to be the governor of this, the president of that, the owner of this, the owner of that. And he was brash, and he was bold. He was not always completely ethical, sometimes downright unethical. But he was sort of the old Wild West meeting, you know, the 20th century kind of guy.
So he meets a young woman named Clara Smith. Can you talk about her and how they first met?
Yeah, so he was about 40 years of age, already had a wife, two kids, and he is living in Lawton, Oklahoma at this time. And one day he walks into what we would call a general store. It'd be like walking into a Target or Woolworths or something. And the girl there was working. Her name was Clara Smith. And she was, by some account, 16, by some account, 17, certainly underage, or what we would say underage for today. And she was smitten with him because he was such a bold guy. And he hung out there a lot, and he talked to her. And over a period of time, she became smitten with him, he with her, and eventually they actually began a love affair that would go for the next 10 years. They met in 1910, and the story would culminate in their lives 10 years later, so for a decade. So from the time she was 17 until the time she was 27, and she became the center of his life by many accounts as far as romance is concerned. And he was her world, and he promised her things. You know, I'm going to take you to the White House. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. She had childhood dreams about being a movie star that would later play prominently, you know, in this story. But they met in a general store in a five and dime kind of place in 1910 in Lawton, Oklahoma.
How successful was he at the point where they meet?
He was probably on the precipice at that time of being close to a millionaire. He was also pretty successful as a politician, even serving the term of the mayor, you know, of the city of Lawton. He would eventually leave Lawton and move on to another town. But he was a very well-known person. And I think the fact that this well-known older man was showing such attention to this young girl really sort of stole her heart. But he was already on his way to being a millionaire, and this was in land transactions, real estate, business deals, always wheeling and dealing, even before the oil business. But once that hit, it took off on steroids.
And what was her background?
Well, she was just a normal girl. She was still in high school, working a job, and possibly, had she never met Jake, she would have lived out her life, married a local high school sweetheart, raised a family in Lawton, Oklahoma. By all accounts, a very stable family environment, parents who loved her. She hid this relationship with an older man, I mean a significantly older man, 20 plus years older than her. She hid it from her parents, and they never knew about it until years later when things got quite ugly. But from all accounts, a very normal home environment, parents, hardworking people, people of the earth, devout, church-going people.
So let's talk about the next few years of their lives together. Are they living together? And where is his wife, Georgia? And what role does Clara take in his business?
Right. Well, Georgia was his legal wife. Georgia and they had two sons, Jake Jr. and Olive was the daughter's name. And by the time of the relationship with Clara, their marriage, they had drifted apart. But she had strong religious values. Divorce wasn't an option. But through his business arrangements, some of her family arrangements, she wound up moving to first Fort Worth, Texas, and then to Chicago, finally, and to live there. So they lived separate lives, which enabled Jake to live his own life on his own terms. He provided for his legal wife very generously, and that seemed to be an arrangement that worked for both of them. Now, as far as Clara was concerned, Clara Smith, he put her through a business school, or what was sort of a business school, to learn secretarial stuff. And she went to work for him in his oil company and all of his enterprises as a personal assistant. And, of course, they were still having this affair. And by this time, they had moved to the town of Ardmore, Oklahoma. And Ardmore was sort of booming at that particular time. And there was a hotel in town called the Randall Hotel. And it wasn't unusual in the teens and the 20s for business people to live and work out of hotels. And so he took up a room at the hotel. There was an adjoining room. They had it arranged where it became one room, but it looked like two rooms, and Clara was in one, and he was the other, but they were certainly living together for all practical purposes. And then, another part of the story was along the way, as they traveled on his business travels, he realized how hard it was to check into hotels in those days with two different last names. And one of the most odd parts of the story, he persuaded Clara, his assistant, and his lover, Mary, his nephew, Frank, so that, and he paid Frank $10,000 so that she could have the last name Heyman. And then a few months later, they got a divorce. So she was Clara Heyman legally, but she was not Clara Heyman, Mrs. Jake Heyman. She was Clara Heyman, Mrs. Frank Heyman, and the marriage was a sham.
And during this time, he meets John Ringling, and they do some business together, don't they?
Right. He had actually worked as a kid one summer for the Ringling Circus, famous, obviously, Ringling Brothers Circus, and famous even into our era, actually just now winding down historically. But so he had known of John Ringling, and Ringling would happen to be in New York City at the Waldorf Astoria. And Jake and Clara made their way to town there. And he was always looking for people to talk about, and he wanted to go into business. And his dream was also to take a railroad line and link Ardmore with some of the other towns in the area, especially where the oil boom was happening. And it so happened he knew that John Ringling owned a tremendous amount of land in that area. So he arranged through Clara a quote-unquote chance meeting. She actually spilled a drink on him in a bar at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. About 1913, this is. And then Jake comes in, and of course, it's all a setup, but Ringling doesn't know it. They get into a conversation. I used to work for you as a kid. And next thing you know, over the course of the next few hours, they work on a deal to bring a railroad out to that land. And there's a town that's established at that time in Oklahoma called Ringling, bearing Ringling's name. And they work together in this enterprise. It was Ringling's money and Jake's expertise that put this together. So by this time, Heyman is an oil person and also a railroad person, so he's building a business empire. And John Ringling of Ringling Brothers Circus was part of this.
Can you talk about Heyman's foray into politics?
Well, he was always interested. You know, there's always been this this crossover between business interests and politics because of money, for one thing, and because they both need each other to a great extent. He tried it early on, always on the Republican side in the early days of Oklahoma there in Lawton. But later on, as the world went into World War I, 1914, 1918, we got in 1917, and, of course, oil was a big part of that. Money was to be made. It was very clear that 1920 was going to be a Republican year, and even 2 years before this, and Jake began to put his sights on being the biggest Republican in Oklahoma. At that time, that meant to be the chairman of the Republican National, or the chairman of the Oklahoma Republican Party, which made him part of the Republican National Committee, what we still call today the RNC. And so he staged an election, or he was part of an election to become the chairman of the party. He even had to bring his real wife back to town, Georgia, as part of a sham, because to be a good Republican, you had to have a family. And he wins the job. He becomes the chairman. And by the time 1920 comes along, and the Republicans are going to pick somebody, Woodrow Wilson's already, he's in ill health. He's not going to run again. The Democrats are in disarray. People don't want anything to do with the rest of the world. They want to get back to business. And a dark horse by the name of Warren Harding, of course, is nominated because he promises something he calls normalcy. And they meet in late 1919, early 1920. And Haman decides that he's going to back this guy and bankroll this guy and help him any way I can. And history tells us that Jake Haman probably spent $1 million of his own money to help Warren Harding both get the nomination in Chicago that year. That was where the smoke-filled room comes from. And then eventually win the election. And the deal was that if Harding was elected, he accepted Haman's money. The quid pro quo was that Harding would put him in the cabinet as the Secretary of the Interior. And at that time, that was the plum post in the government because of the oil reserves in the American West. Tremendous oil reserves, and whoever was Secretary of Interior was the most important man, controlling how they got released and who got to use them. These were federal lands, and of course, eventually, after Harding dies, we know what came out, the Teapot Dome scandal. It all had to do with oil. Well, Jake Haman was going to be the person to run all of that until other things got in the way.
One of the interesting moments for me in reading about Jake Haman's initial meeting with Senator Harding is when Harding's wife suddenly drops some bombshell information. Could you talk about that meeting and what she told Haman?
Well, Warren Harding's wife, of course, she's a senator from Ohio, and his wife, her name is Florence. She's always been a powerful influence on him, and by all accounts, a very strong-minded lady, even among the political staff. The nickname for her, although never to her face, they called her the Duchess. She was like a big princess kind of person. Well, when Jake Haman finally meets in a New York hotel, Warren Harding, at some kind of mixer. Clara is back in Oklahoma. Jake is there by himself. He is introduced, I think, by John Ringling to Warren Harding, a potential presidential nominee. And Florence Harding comes over, and Florence says, "Oh, I know who you are." And it sort of takes Jake back. And it's at that moment that a piece of the puzzle comes out that Jake never knew, and that Georgia, because they're so estranged, he and his wife, never talked about. But Jake's legal wife, Georgia, is a cousin to Florence Harding, and they sort of grew up together when they were young children. And all of a sudden, Jake Haman finds out that his wife is related to the future, or what he hopes will be the future First Lady of the United States. Now, this is Jake Haman, who is living in an adulterous affair, a woman much younger than him, estranged from his wife, but still legally married to her, and he wants to really buddy up to Warren Harding and put all the money in his pocket and be part of the cabinet, and all of a sudden he finds out one piece of the puzzle. Oops, my wife is related to her. And as you can imagine, that was news that he would have liked to have known long before that.
Incredible. So he basically has to make up with his wife now. doesn't he?
Yeah, an arrangement. And she's amenable to that because basically Warren Harding himself was a lot like Jake. Warren Harding was a womanizer. It's well known. I mean, there are books out about it, how he had a child with another woman named Nan. And he had women all over the place, and Florence knew about it, but they had a sort of a marriage arrangement. But she wanted everything to look right, and she basically told her husband, Warren, if you're going to have this guy in your political family, my cousin, his wife, needs to be part of the process. And so they came to an arrangement. Jake made nice with Georgia back in Chicago. Of course, it was in Chicago where the convention was in the first place when Harding was chosen, so they were all there nearby. And the bottom line is his legal wife was at his side during that campaign as he was helping Warren Harding get elected. And it was always understood, and Florence, the Duchess, made it so clear that if this guy is going to be in your cabinet, the woman he's going to bring to Washington is going to be his real wife. Not some floozy, you know, as she would have called her from out in Oklahoma. It was an understanding. Clara, all the while, is unaware of any of this, at least only partially aware, and doesn't realize what it's going to mean for her. Because Jake had always promised her, when I finally reach the top, baby, I'm taking you with me. I'll divorce my wife, you know, the old promise that the philandering men make, you know. And it's a sad story.
And Clara meets Georgia once, right? Could you talk about this encounter that the two of them have?
Yeah, Georgia comes back to Ardmore, Oklahoma, which is, of course, where Jake lives, and is aware of Clara's existence. I mean, she's not dumb. Their daughter, Olive, plays the violin, and she's been asked to play at some big event in the Civic Hall in town. And when they get to town there, Georgia, Jake's real legit wife, pays a visit to the Randall Hotel and surprises Clara, sort of challenges her, doesn't threaten her, somewhat does, basically, but very much so intimidates her, and it rattles Clara, and so they have sort of this kind of standoff, and so tensions start to rise between the three of them, and whenever you have that kind of, you know, that kind of triangle, that love triangle, something is bound to happen. And I think a collision, they were on a collision course from that point to something that wasn't going to end all that pleasant.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories. Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
So Harding, of course, is elected president, and as you've already inferred, his success has much to do with Haman's money, the money he funneled into the campaign. So now they meet, and Haman makes it known to Harding that he wants to be Secretary of the Interior. Can you tell us about the conversation he has with Harding about this?
Yeah, they have a series of conversations. And by the way, Haman's money was not only important. Haman was a shrewd politician, and Harding at first, like another Ohio guy named McKinley before him, decided he wanted to run a campaign from his front porch in Ohio, but it wasn't going to work. And it was Haman who persuaded him, hey, you need to get on a train, get out on the road, and go talk to people. And he scheduled one of the biggest events of the entire campaign in Oklahoma City, and Haman set that whole thing up. And so they'd had a series of discussions about this, and you know, whenever anybody helps anybody in a political campaign, we've seen that here recently, you know, there's always speculation, what's he doing it for, what does he want? Well, Haman clearly wanted the job of Secretary of Interior, and basically Harding said, it's yours, but my wife says, Clara's got to go, and you're taking Georgia with you to the White House, or to Washington to live. And those were the terms. If he wasn't willing to break it off with Clara and bring his wife and live together as man and wife with Georgia and Jake Jr. and Olive Bell in Washington, he couldn't have the job. And Jake agreed to it. He just did not break the news to Clara.
Right. So the Hardings dispatch a man named Jess Smith to make sure that Haman separates himself from Clara, right?
Exactly. Now, if anybody has ever watched, HBO did a series a few years ago called Boardwalk Empire. And some of these Harding people, Jess Smith is one of the characters. He is sort of Warren Harding's fixer, right? And so he goes to Ardmore to try to see how it's going. Harding sends him, you know, check it out. Has that guy really broken it off with that girl? They're scheduled to have a big dinner, and finally Haman, who has put it off, has the showdown with Clara and tells her, hey, I'm having to break this off. I'm moving to Washington with Georgia and the kids, and I'm going to give you whatever you need. I'll give you money. I'll give you whatever you need, but this is the way it's going to be. And, of course, she does not take that very well, and she processes it for a while. And then takes matters into her hands.
Absolutely, she does. So let's talk about the night of the roast duck dinner in Ardmore, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, this is for Jess Hill. It's to celebrate. Basically, it's almost like a send off. Jake's going to Washington to be part of the cabinet. Jess was there to make sure, and right in the middle of this, And, of course, alcohol plays a role in this. Right in the middle of this, Clara comes down from the hotel room to make, and she makes a scene. It embarrasses Jake, you know. And a little later then, up in the room, they have an argument. And, you know, the facts are in dispute. They were part of the trial. He said, she said. What we know for a fact is that at some point, Clara accesses a pistol, and she shot Jake Heyman in the abdomen, and then she ran out, and he ran out. He comes stumbling down the stairs. Some of his friends see him stumbling down the stairs, bleeding profusely in the hotel lobby. They walk, this is a Sunday night, they walk down several blocks to what's called a sanitarium, called the Hardy Sanitarium in Ardmore, Oklahoma, another name for a hospital. And they take him into the emergency room, and all hell breaks loose, and they still want to cover, he still wants the job in Washington. He even gets a wire from Warren Harding, the job is still yours. All the while, he's trying to cover the fact that his story, he was cleaning his own gun and this happened. And of course, that story does not last very long. Meanwhile, Clara, he makes arrangements for her to get out of town. I think she does have some remorse at first. And she leaves town and disappears, flees the scene. And there's basically a manhunt that lasts for about a month. Or woman hunt, as the case may be, to find her. And part of the story is not only the shooting, and meanwhile, 5 or 6 days later, Heyman dies of the bullet wound. Big funeral in the town. And he dies, and Clara is still in the wind, and then that becomes a story that just captivates the papers, the Hearst papers and other papers around the country. Where is Clara? I mean, this is a monstrous story. In this day and age now, if 24/7 news, this would be a monstrous story to have a business person who's going to be in Donald Trump's cabinet all of a sudden is shot by his mistress and she's gone and he's dead and they're looking all over the country for her. If you can just imagine how big a story this was in late 1920 and going into 1921.
Right. And before Jake dies, he's very optimistic that he'll recover. But the bullet has entered his liver, and right. It's looking pretty grim.
He had a lot of damage from alcohol, too. So he had some health challenges that I think contributed to it.
But he's still really sympathetic to Clara. He doesn't blame her. He still wants her gone for her own good. And as soon as she departs, his wife Georgia arrives and is able to see him just before he passes, right?
Yes. And, you know, Georgia's a hard lady to figure out. I mean, this is a man that treated her badly and that she stayed with him. It seems her actions seem to tell me that she stayed with him not so much out of love, but because out of the life she had with him and the access to money and a certain social standing, still living in Chicago. But she comes now by his side as a dutiful wife and becomes the wife and becomes now the spokesperson and she'll be the bereaved widow and so forth. And I don't doubt that, of course, she was. Because he was the father of her children, but I think she also played it up for sympathy and for her own personal reasons. She even at one point, after he died, tried to replace him on the Republican National Committee, take his ambition. So she was a very ambitious woman herself.
Absolutely, and I'd like to talk to you about that in a moment. Let's shift to Clara. She's handed $5,000, and eventually makes her way to Mexico. Can you tell us about her journey south?
Right. She travels just sort of this circuitous kind of route. She goes to Dallas, hires a driver. She is spotted here, spotted there. A lot of the sightings, of course, are bogus. There are even evidence that people played, for whatever reason, the part of her for sightings. And she winds up, after several weeks, crossing over at El Paso, where, in fact, her parents are living now. They've moved now from Lawton, Oklahoma, over the years, to El Paso, Texas. And she crosses over into Mexico with some money from Jake. and from his associates that have enabled her to do this, and they have some people down there south of the border who are going to help her. They have a large villa down there, and she wound up staying there for a couple of weeks at least, and hiding out. No one knows where she is. It's the big story. Where is Clara? Where did she go? And she winds up down in Mexico. She doesn't speak the language. She doesn't know much about it. That story in itself in the book is fascinating because these people are into some weird religious stuff, what's called spiritualism, you know, talking to the dead, you know, and seances and mediums and all of this kind of stuff. And on her trail are a couple of law people, and I'll just mention this. I'm sure you're going to ask about this, but there's a couple of lawmen from Carter County, Oklahoma, from the Ardmore area, and one is a sheriff by the name of Buck Garrett, very colorful sheriff, and his deputy is a guy named Bud Ballou, and they are famous people themselves, but they become very famous for a while across the country as lawmen, because they're the men that are on the trail of Clara, and I liken them to Andy Griffith and Barney Fife on steroids, because Buck Garrett was sort of a sheriff who reasoned with people, colorful person, drove a white horse downtown, ice cream to the kids, a beloved character. Bud Ballou was a guy who would say, ready, fire, aim, shoot first, ask questions later. They were an odd couple, but they seemed to work together, but they were the two lawmen. That to me is a fascinating part of the story that I develop, I think, in detail in the book.
Yeah, it really is. And another fascinating character that you write about is a newspaper reporter named Sam Blair, who's
right.
dispatched from Chicago for the story. Can you talk about how he's given this story and his own investigative process?
Right. Well, of course, this was the big day of newspapers, and his editor, owner, a guy named Brisbane there in Chicago. This is part of the Hearst Network, and of course, as people might know, that was much more of a sensational tabloid kind of newspaper, not quite the National Enquirer, but you know, very juicy, gossipy kind of newspaper. And so Blair is sent down to Ardmore. And when Clara left, a little fact, when Clara left Ardmore, they did a little feint. They did a little switcheroo. They sent some of her luggage to Kansas City as a way to throw some people off the trail. And the rumor became that Clara had gone to Kansas City on the train, which she didn't. But Blair followed that luggage to Kansas City, got a hold of it, just like reporters do, you know, Woodward, Bernstein, you know, whatever you got to do. And found in the luggage a diary that Clara had been keeping for many years about her relationship with Jake. And it was juicy stuff. And the bottom line is the Hearst papers got a hold of this through the reporter and began to publish on the front page of the newspapers all around the country. I have copies of the main newspaper. The Hearst newspaper was the San Francisco Examiner, I believe it was. And I have copies of the diary on the front page of that in my files. And I quote from that. These are the sources I quote from verbatim. But it was a very salacious story. This is 1920. This is the beginning of the Jazz Age, the beginning of the Roaring Twenties. You could call it the first real big scandal of the 20s, certainly the biggest trial. And this diary, and Blair makes a name for himself as a reporter and actually winds up through this process establishing contact with Clara in Mexico and helps to effectuate her surrender to the authorities.
He actually finds her faster than the sheriff and the deputy do.
Right, exactly. And because he's persuaded her what he's going to help her in her best interest and so forth. And she has read these accounts in the papers. The papers have gotten to her. They've been brought into Mexico. She's read maybe a day later, but she's reading all about herself. And let's go back to something about Clara. When she was a young girl, she wanted to be a celebrity. She wanted to be a star. You know, this was the early days of Hollywood. And so the attention was something I think that was very, 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 very seductive. And there was a certain amount of sympathy because after Heyman was buried, more and more came out. He had a lot of enemies. And over the next few weeks, Clara became a more sympathetic character, even though she was the fallen woman. The fact that he was so much older, and the fact, you know, there was a lot of sympathy being developed, and she was becoming sort of a cause celeb, I guess you could call it, around the country, via the media attention as it was at the time.
So I do want to ask you about this, because this is pretty impressive to me. Georgia, his wife, attempts to jockey herself politically into the mix, which is pretty impressive considering it's Oklahoma and women have just recently been given the right to vote. Can you talk about what her plan is a little bit more?
Well, I think her plan was unrealistic. She wanted to replace Jake as the chairman of the Republican Party in Oklahoma, therefore part of the RNC. She did have a relationship with, of course, the First Lady now, the new First Lady elect, I guess you could call her, who was related to her. And she used all of those things to try to establish that. But the politicians of Oklahoma, the Republicans, didn't vote for it. They voted in someone else. And after that, Georgia becomes a footnote in the story, other than the grieving widow and the estate that's going to be divided up and so forth after this particular time. So it was, and I think there were probably people that thought it was unseemly. And remember, this is 1920. This is the first year, political year, that women in America had the right to vote in the national presidential election. And it's obvious from the polling, and I've researched this, that it was the woman's vote that really did help Warren Harding to get elected, because he was handsome and he was charming, and of course the mood of the times. But at the end of the day, I don't think the Hardings, even though she was related to Florence, wanted any hint of any of this whole Haman story involved in their fledgling presidents. Now, remember, Harding's elected in November, and at this time, presidents weren't inaugurated until the 4th of March. It wasn't changed back until the days of FDR to the 20th of January. So it was a much longer interim period for presidents-elect. A lot could develop. And so Georgia sort of is relegated to the sidelines. She's rejected in this. Why she wanted it, I don't know. She was, I think she enjoyed the spotlight, enjoyed the sympathy. I don't want to be too hard on her, because I think she was treated badly throughout the years by her husband. But at the same time, they have an arrangement that she must have agreed to as well.
Many of the women in the forefront of the suffragist movement found more sympathy with the Republican Party in 1920. And a lot of the female voters were also members of temperance movements and anti-saloon organizations. And prohibition plays a whole part in this drama too, doesn't it?
Right, and that's a big part of the story, because prohibition, the Volstead Act, I think it becomes the law of the land in early 1920, January of 1920. And as a result of this, you know, you can't buy or sell liquor. And yet, liquor is such a big part of the story. Jake Haman was virtually an alcoholic. By this time, Clara was probably close to being an alcoholic. Warren Harding, who was elected, loved his alcohol. So everybody was drinking it. I mean, it's part of the story of that particular era. But the official position of the Republican Party was they were very much for prohibition, because it had been ratified by the requisite number of states to become the law of the land. And so we hadn't yet seen the violence break out that would break out early in the 20s and all of that over prohibition. It was a national experiment that failed miserably. But women, yes, in fact, one of the largest organizations was called the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And I think if the history of prohibition is written correctly, it will show that this group, women, and the suffragette movement, getting them the vote, and the prohibition movement, the banning of alcohol, women were by far the dominant force in these things, and other social reforms, you know, child labor, some of the other progressive reforms that needed to happen in the country.
So Clara turns herself in. high-profile lawyers are lining up to defend her, and she's escorted back to Ardmore. Tell us about her arrival there. What was the scene like as she's escorted back into town?
Well, it's Christmas Day 1920, first of all, and, you know, so you have this giant mob waiting at the railroad. The newspapers have been saying for days that a couple of days she's coming back. She arrives to town on this train. She's met by a cheering crowd, even though she's in custody, by Bud Ballou and Buck Garrett, and taken right over to the courthouse for arraignment. But it's very clear by this time that she has become a tremendously sympathetic character. So sympathetic that in the previous election that November, there was a person named James Mathers who was elected as the county prosecutor in that county, who by all rights should have been the person prosecuting Clara Smith Hayman for the murder of Jake Hayman. And she was indicted for that, and she would be charged with that, and she would go to trial for that. But he actually postponed taking his job as county prosecutor because a lot of people had so many bad dealings with Jake Hayman. He was a wheeler dealer, either loved him or hated him. He became part of her defense team. That shows how much public sentiment there was against Jake Hayman and all the garbage that was coming out. And here he had this affair with this young girl, blah, blah, blah. And then a couple of other attorneys, most prominently the attorney that I mentioned in my first book who defended that preacher in 1927, his name is William Bill, Wild Bill, they called him, McLean, and he also is part of the dream team, the defense team, to defend Clara against murder charges. But she comes to town as a hero. She's a sympathetic figure. There's a couple of female reporters famous at the time who write very, very strong pro-opinions about how this man abused her and how he took advantage of her virtue, and it really wasn't her fault, and that when she shot him, it was an act of a desperate person in self-defense. And it has all the makings, you see, of this social story that captures the attention of the country.
What is the prosecution's strategy going into the trial? And what are Clara's lawyers' plans for her defense?
Well, the prosecution was going to try to show that she was not justified in shooting him, that she shot him in a premeditated way out of anger because he had broken off this relationship and he'd lied to her, and that that Jake wasn't that bad a guy, you know, took a father away from his children and his wife. The defense painted Jake as a very wicked guy, a person who abused her, and even in the trial, they build a case that he had physically abused her, and even that very night in the Randall Hotel, in Ardmore, had hit her and had physically hurt her, and that she shot completely in self-defense. And so that's sort of how it all played out. The fact that she shot him was never in dispute. She never denied it. Her defense never denied it. But they felt like it was a justified shooting.
What are your personal thoughts on the reason she shot him? Do you think he was abusive towards her?
Well, I think he was. And I think he was in many ways over the years. But I think you could build a case, I think, that she was probably guilty of manslaughter at the least. And the fact that she ran, even though he had bankrolled it, was incriminating at the point. But one of the things that I think is fascinating, Eric, about this case is that this is one of the first cases that gets such national attention. You know, you're going into the 20s, you're going to have the Scopes Monkey trial, you're going to have the J. Frank Norris case that I write about in 1927, you have Sacco and Vanzetti, you have Leopold and Lowe, and you have some of these major cases that everybody's talking about. This is the first time this has happened. And Clara's trial for the killing of Jake was like, so you have people on all sides of the issue. And because you have such a strong women's movement, the progressive movement, the prohibition, the election of Harding, there's a tremendous sympathy for women being abused and being the underdog, the beginning of feminism. So at the end of the day, I feel like Jake sort of got what he had coming. I, from my vantage point, he was a terrible husband. He took advantage of this girl. He promised her the moon. She didn't give it to him. I don't think she shot him in a vacuum. I believe they were both under the influence of alcohol that night, and I believe a fight got out of hand, and she took advantage of that. I don't think he ever thought she would shoot him. And the fact that he forgave her and tried to cover for her suggests to me that he knew that he was the guilty party, not her.
In the meantime, in Hollywood, California, a man named John Gorman is hatching some plans of his own. Can you tell us about those plans?
Yeah, he's a low-level Hollywood producer. He's produced a couple of films that have come out. This is still the silent era, right? And so he reads about this story in the Hearst paper in Los Angeles, follows it, as does everybody. And by the time she comes back to Ardmore, brought to town, he comes to town and decides, just like somebody following somebody into maybe they get the rights to the story, this would make a great movie. Well, he finds her, and she's actually at her sister's house. She's been released. She's on bail or on her. She's not being held in jail until the trial, even though she had fled, which I found to be an interesting harbinger of how it was going to be handled legally. So he meets her, and he talks to her, this producer, John Gorman, about this would make a great movie. She agrees. Remember, this is a girl that always wanted to be a movie star. And he's going to write the film. She could help him write the film, but we can't do anything until the trial's over. Let's see how this works out. So he attends the trial, makes notes. He's writing this thing all along. And the bottom line is whatever's going to happen in the trial, which we can talk about here in a second, you know, he wants to make a movie about it with or without her.
Right. And they develop a pretty close relationship, too, right?
Some point they develop a love affair, and I can just take you right through the trial. They come to the trial. It's in March of 1921. It doesn't last very long. It lasts just a few days. The jury is out for 40 minutes. I cover it length in the book, Jake and Clara, Scandal, Politics, Hollywood, and Murder. I think that's probably the part of the book that there is just absolutely no fiction to at all. I didn't have to recreate any dialogue and find a way that it's all there in the record, and I have all the transcripts and stuff. And after a 40-minute deliberation, she's acquitted on all accounts. And at this point, John Gorman and her pretty much go public with their plans. They're going to write a movie. It's going to be called Fate, F-A-T-E, just one word. She's going to get some money, and she has some money, and getting more from Jake's estate, not a lot. And she invests just about everything she has in this film. It's produced that year, 1921. And before it comes out, John Gorman and Clara Smith Heyman get married in a church in Los Angeles. So he gets the girl as well as the story. And then the movie comes out, and that itself is an interesting story.
The whole thing is an interesting story. From beginning to end.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the release of the film?
Right, and this is the fascinating part. And I actually begin the book. I begin the book with sort of a prologue in 1921, in September, with the world premiere of the movie Fate in San Francisco, California. Also happens to be the same time that another infamous, in fact, the most famous movie star of the time was a comedian called Fatty Arbuckle. And he is in town as well. He'll have his own scandal that's been written about many times. But they have the release in San Francisco, but the censors, you know, at that time you have censorship. They call the movie pornographic because it deals with adultery. By the way, Clara plays herself in the movie. It's called Fate. Another famous actor they get in the silent film to play Jake Heyman. It is going to be released. There's a grand premiere. She gets out of the car. Her husband gets out of the car with the producer. They go into the theater. Everybody's popping the, you know, the cameras and, hey, Clara, hey, Clara. But there are also signs there calling her an adulteress and down with this film. But before the film could be screened, the police raid the theater, a famous theater in San Francisco. This accounts in the book. They seize the copies of the film. It's done all over the country this way. The film was banned. It was shown on a few obscure theaters once or twice. It was banned, and not only banned, it was burned. There are no copies of this film. Now, there are many books, and I have texts in my library from early Hollywood. This story is a footnote. This is a movie that was produced. You can go to, you know, the International Data Movie Base, you know, that you go to, and you can look at Clara Haymond. You could look at Fate. You'll find it there, but there are no copies, to the best of my knowledge, in existence of this film whatsoever. It was only banned, it was burned, and it's a significantly interesting part of early Hollywood that is lost forever. And I've always, the story is being, I have an agent in Hollywood shopping this as a mini-series and so forth, but there's so many things that are being shopped all the time. But I think this would make, I would just wish somebody would notice this aspect of it that I think even makes the story more interesting for a Hollywood kind of release.
Well, I might have some listeners from Hollywood. you never know.
That'd be great.
What's really interesting to me is that at the time of her trial, she's portrayed as such a sympathetic character. What happens between the point where she's acquitted and the point where this movie is made? Had the tide turned against her? Were people seeing things differently? I mean, what was it about this movie that caused people to go out and burn the copies?
You know, I think what it was that they were sympathetic with her when she was the underdog and she was the victim. But then it looked to many people like she was exploiting this story in an unseemly kind of way. It was one thing for a woman back then to be the victim of abuse and to stand up for herself and to do what she felt like she had to do, no matter how it was to do it. It was quite another thing to go on the road and make a show of it and try to exploit it for personal attention or personal fame. You know, I think it was Sinclair Lewis that called the 20s the age of ballyhoo, which is another word for just, you know, blowing your own horn. And I think in an age of celebrity, she really became one of the first celebrities, her 15 minutes of fame, so-called. And I think that was seen to be unseemly. I think they wanted the story to go away. I mean, you know, if you have young girls in your home and you're trying to tell them, well, you know, sometimes you have to do what's right. Never let a man take advantage of you. And then all of a sudden you marry a producer and let him take advantage of you and produce a film about the whole thing to make money off this sordid story. Yeah, that just didn't sit well with many people.
So what happens to Clara Smith Haymond after that?
Well, you know, she goes away and she eventually divorces John Gorman. She married again. You know what's really interesting about this story, Eric, is I spent, you know, a year or two researching it, boxes and boxes of newspapers, internet searches, texts. I've got a bibliography. You know, for a fiction book, you don't usually get a lengthy bibliography in the back of the book, but I have that. And yet, I don't even know. I cannot find a record of when she died. So she literally eventually faded away, and she was gone. I'm thinking she probably died sometime in the 1940s and 1950s, but I never could find the date and where she's buried. So, you know, it's that part is sad. I mean, she just totally went away. And I tried hard. I probably could. There are probably a couple of other places I could have checked. Never did the Ancestry.com stuff and so forth because it really wasn't part of my story, but never have actually been able to locate just exactly where her story ended, you know. But she faded away. She went away, and it's a sad, sad story. She never did anything of significance again.
Well, if any of my listeners want to get on that,
yes.
Find the date of her death, they can forward it to you or I.
Yeah, my website is davidrstokes.com, They can find information about the book there, some of my other books, and there's even a link there directly to my publisher, Critical Mass, where I can send an autographed copy if somebody wants one. But that's where they can find out and contact me.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. This has been great.
You're welcome. And thank you for reaching out, and I hope folks enjoy the book about Jake and Clara.
And again, I've been speaking to David R. Stokes, the author of Jake and Clara, Scandal, Politics, Hollywood, and Murder. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and as always, have a safe tomorrow.